You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
We have an amazing guest for you today, Chris Wilson, who just completed her master's thesis for the Chicago Theological Seminary titled A Culture of Entitlement, Cult Indoctrination Tactics and Consent Violations in American Christianity. We'll link the thesis in our show notes. Chris's work includes ministering to people in the areas of religious trauma, healthy community building, and alternative forms of faith. With a group of 10 others, she founded the Progressive Clergy of TikTok in May 2020. Now there are over 200 different ecumenical and interfaith clergy on the app, and it has almost 103 million views. Chris's thesis developed around her engagement with these communities. At the end of the show, we'll tell you where you can find her on social media. Chris, tell us a little bit about your background and how and why you became interested in this thesis topic.
Well, to be perfectly honest, I've got kind of a background that involves a lot of loss and trauma. And with that, I was the little kid who went to the library as my coping mechanism. And so I found psychology and belief in religion when I was about 7, and I started studying. And it continued to be relevant in my life. So as I was leading interfaith groups, as a teenager, as I was dealing with so many different things, the ideas continued to stay with me to the point where after I got out of the military, I finished a bachelor's in sociology. I did an undergraduate thesis on the intergenerational transmission of trauma. And when I felt a call to go to seminary, it just seemed like a natural progression for me because I moved into spaces of religious trauma, profound religious trauma. And so I took classes about it. I've been very lucky to have chaplains who have focused in on this at Chicago Theological Seminary. And I was able to really do some in-depth research on that.
So we started talking with Chris before the recording began, and I was having a total geek out moment because I follow Chris on TikTok, but I didn't realize it until I saw your face come up on the screen today. But now I understand. So we were introduced to Chris through a mutual friend, Hannah Smith. And Hannah understood that we study the same problem, religious trauma. I study it through the concept of incarceration, and you study it through this thesis is about cult indoctrination tactics and consent violation. And so I'm always curious about how people come to the framing they use. So why did you say, I get the cult indoctrination practices, but the consent violations is such a new way for me to think about this. I'm curious how you settled on consent violation.
Well, part of my background has been working in sexualities education. And so when I've been educating around consent in various alternative communities, the framing of social engagement has been something that truly, has been marked by a sense of entitlement of some people versus a sense of true mutual consent. And it's difficult because a lot of people don't think of it that way. Even in my definition of religion talks about the social function of religion, which most people don't use. They use the belief framework. Right. And so for me, it's a lot about looking at this from a completely different angle because we've been assuming way too much, and assumption is part of violating consent.
That's true. Well, the other thing that you were writing about sort of in your intro to your thesis is that how Christianity is perceived overall in America is often marked by extremes rather than moderate averages, that that the beliefs and practices in and of themselves are not problematic. There's like this tipping point. Now, I think that the extremes exist more than people like to think they do, but I just really like that you kind of presenced that for people. Your overall structure, I was kind of reading it, and you talk about things like, well, abuse, the cult indoctrination practices, the fear and using fear and domination, and centering whiteness, maleness, heterosexuality, wealth, cisgendered people, able-bodied people, neurotypical people, abusers, and all forms of privilege, which I love because, of course, I wouldn't have thought to include neurotypical people, but now I do. Thank you for that. But that centering of outside the typical whiteness, maleness, heterosexuality, wealth is an interesting one. Why was that important for you to make sure that you included cisgendered people, able-bodied people, neurotypical?
Well, I am trained by an organization called the IAF, the Industrial Areas Foundation, which is one of the oldest faith-based community organizing groups in the country. And the IAF focuses in on how this idea of power and privilege interact with the world. Sociologically, it, you know, is a kind of conflict theory around how people with power, the haves and have-nots. And looking at that, we have to look at the understanding of privilege not as a singular, you have privilege or you don't have privilege. That's the common narrative that we get all the time. Oh, well, I can't have privilege because I've had a hard life. No, that's not how it works, but that's the common understanding. So for me, naming these things, saying, hey, this is all of those things. You may have, be a white, straight man who also grew up in abject poverty, who grew up with these toxic mentalities. And I think naming this on different levels helps people engage and see themselves in a way that maybe they've rejected that narrative before because it wasn't explained in a way that they could relate to.
That point you just made, I want to wrap back around to later. But sorry, I see Deborah's going to ask you a question.
I'm always poised to ask a question, Chris. One of the things that you write about in your thesis is the theologies of control over others. That's a big theme in what you talk about. Your research explores these issues in Christianity. Is it fair to say that they exist in pretty much every other organized institutional religion in the world, both historically and geographically?
Absolutely. Sociologically, the understanding of power and domination, of authoritarian control, doesn't even have to have religion as a framework. Religion in and of itself is simply one more social construct that allows people to have an excuse to control, meaning that regardless of the objective realness of any one particular belief, having a infinite power or grandiose power of some sort that is on your side that is unverifiable by anyone else does lend itself to a kind of authority that can be abusive and even narcissistic.
You made a statement speaking on theologies of control. I really want to dig into some of the particularities of what you've included in your thesis. But you made a statement that I found so interesting because it's something I've been wondering about. So you say that it's that churches are becoming more controlling and regressive as fear of irrelevance begins to interact with the individual beliefs and fears of a given community, which I just found to be kind of a profound statement. And it made me think too of how towards the end you were talking about the sort of the prominence of digital spaces for ministry and how those are becoming more popular or more, I guess the pandemic has maybe also contributed to that, but they're bigger for areas of ministry and those are online spaces. So churches proper would, you know, be impacted by that. Is that what you mean by that? Or do you mean something else by that?
Well, I think there's many different layers to this. One of the elements shows up where there's there's polarization because of the fact that in society we are beginning to move into an ideological argument with one another over baseline ideals more than the, you know, in ancient times we had our tribes, we had our small, you know, family groupings, our small tribes of people who would interact with one another. And it was easy to know an us versus them. What we're running into is a broader scale ideological baseline of where people are trying to figure out where they belong in society. That goes, I actually cut an entire section out about Durkheim's anomie theory around the normlessness in society, because this plays into that. People are looking for identity. They are looking for a sense of belonging. They are looking for a sense of meaning and purpose and trajectory in their life. And even just looking at the past year, how many people lost their sense of normlessness because a pandemic hit? And even as we move on to online spaces, this is the uncharted territories of our era. The internet is the Wild West in many ways of our era, where we are looking at unregulated space. The laws have not kept up. The regulations, even the moderation of apps like TikTok, have not kept up with the extreme behaviors that they can engender through things like marketing algorithms. So we are finding a polarization in that people are looking for simple answers in a complex world. And therefore, there is a feedback loop once you find people who are similar that lends itself to radicalization.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the polarization. You also talk about polarized thinking and polarized volatility leading to more extremist beliefs. And you say it matters whether believers view the world as an all or nothing game to win the spiritual soul of the world. The more radicalized the beliefs, the more control is needed to sustain those claims. The fewer people are allowed to question authority, the more likely it is these tactics will end up as religious trauma. Yeah. And I'm wondering, are you like, you sort of talk about it, but can you speak a little bit about the religious trauma from your own background, or is it really born out of, you know, interactions with other people?
It's a little bit of both for me. I grew up in a conservative Episcopal church as well as a Southern Baptist church. And my mother was the Southern Baptist, my father was the Episcopal, but the Southern Baptist church happened to have the family, you know, events and things like that. So that's where we went mostly. But the church was a large church. It was a First Baptist church. And the theology actually was kind of progressive, considering they broke away from the Southern Baptist Convention because they were willing to ordain women as children's ministers only, but they were willing to ordain women, which caused a break from that. But the church as an institution still had lots of problems. When my father died when I was 11, the church failed us. To be perfectly honest, the inability for the church to call out things in my life as well about abuse, when I was being bullied by kids in the church youth groups, when I was seeing things that were happening that were wrong in those groups, and nobody was addressing those things. There was a lot of times where, for me, even as a kid, I recognized something wasn't quite right. And I didn't realize how common it was in general until I began creating these other groups, because I wanted community. And I began to kind of take on leadership roles and make my own group of interfaith friends who were trying to find their way. And I started to hear their stories. And I heard the rejection that they were receiving too. The pain, the loss, the rejection because of their identities, which I received only a little bit of, because I wasn't open about them when I was in the church, but I knew it wouldn't be accepted. And so as the more I worked with these groups, building these groups wherever I lived, the more I just found I felt like I was a sin eater in that kind of way of hearing everybody's pain and trauma and stories. And I've always been that person where I could just walk into a room and somebody felt the need to tell me their life story. My husband teases me all the time. You know, he's like, okay, who told you their life story today if I go out anywhere? Yeah. Because it happens with me. And I don't mind being one who collects stories. It's something that's meaningful to me. Because as I've moved through this and I have heard more and more people's stories, and I've moved on to TikTok and have people telling me their stories all the time, that has only driven my own ability to heal and my desire to carry that torch for other people to be able to find their way on that path.
Beautifully said. I want to ask you about the youth group experiences, because you write quite a bit in your thesis about youth groups and some of the kind of the souped up worship services. We live in Oklahoma. We've got big churches and they do a lot of that. We've got Falls Creek. I don't know if you're familiar with Falls Creek. As a Southern Baptist, you probably are. Largest evangelical gathering in the world. But you also mentioned cry nights, and you just got some really interesting things to say about how youth groups are used to, I don't know if that was in the section with emotional hijacking. I think it might have been, but I found those comments really, really interesting. Would you speak to those a little bit? And for people, we were talking with a guest recently, David Hayward, who was talking in a roundabout way about the cry night, how people are sort of forced to reveal. So, but I would love to hear your take on that and your take on the phenomenon around youth groups with this kind of phenomenon.
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of those things where the most influential people of various, for good or evil, have recognized that the youth are the future and that youth are impressionable. What does a teenager want? A teenager wants a sense of identity. A teenager coming up is trying to figure out who they are. They're testing boundaries. They are, not as an insult to any teenager out there, but it's toddler plus. Toddlers have moved from the baby stage and are moving into the kid stage, and they're going through this transition of testing boundaries, testing limits, new developmental growth all over the place. Teenagers are doing the same thing. They're testing boundaries all over the place. It's a new level, but it's the same behaviors. And so they're pushing buttons. They're trying stuff out. So what does the church need to do? The church needs to convince them that they need to stay because they're the future. So they become a focus of a lot of these programs. And I work with some women who do the Troubled podcast, who do intervention work for the troubled teen industry. And they work in advocacy in Missouri. And that group has been instrumental in my awareness of just how profound and widespread a lot of these issues are. So we talk about the cry nights and how these youth group events or summer camps will have this kind of intense emotional service at the end of a week, at the close. And I've experienced that. It was interesting because I was thinking back to my experiences at summer camp, and the Christian summer camps all had that kind of intense emotional service at, sunset, candlelight service, all of the ambiance. And I remember that was when everybody did these altar calls, these, rededications, all of those things. And it's where we look at that and go, okay, well, these people are coming to Christ. This is a good thing, right? In church mentality, the idea that this emotive thing is a positive. But when I started tracing it back and talking to about the troubled teen industry, and I looked at things like studying ABA therapy and the origins of that with conversion therapy. And when I looked at the study, those things that were also used, and this kind of abusive behaviorism in which they were using this on teen anti-gay indoctrination camps, and that looked into the entire troubled teen industry in which they're taking these teens and putting them in these camps and boarding schools as an intervention and using extreme cult indoctrination tactics. So what we're seeing is that this was the origin point of these abusive behaviors, and that has kind of titrated down into mainstream usage without anyone. Most people who are using these cry nights have no idea what they're actually using. They think they're doing it for the benefit of everyone. They think they're doing it because it creates emotions that would make somebody feel close to God. but they have no idea the psychological impact of this. And at best, they're ignorant, and at worst, they know what they're doing. And that's even more terrifying.
Yeah, that's even worse. Well, you mentioned that it creates a codependency on the church because you want to have that feeling again, that feeling of, you know, encounter with the divine. But it's a kind of a natural outgrowth of this process of psychological indoctrination, I think is what you were.
I was just thinking, and this is probably why you saw my wheels turning, Chris, when you were talking about the summer camps, I grew up Jewish in New Mexico, and I only went to day camp. So I never had that kind of closing ceremony that you're talking about. We went in, we played games, we sang a few songs, we rode the horses, and we went home. So this is very interesting to me to hear a completely different experience.
It's interesting. I've worked with some folks in the Jewish communities who've been part of more conservative varieties of Jewish practice and faith. And I've heard similar stories from them as well, which is an interesting thing because most of my experience with the Jewish faith is with more reformed and progressive rabbis. And so hearing that and recognizing that we cannot mark any faith by their extreme points was such an important lesson as I was encountering people of various faiths who were telling me their own stories of their, you know, experiences with such tactics.
Chris, we cannot not talk about, I mean, in terms of theologies of control, we can't not talk about the purity culture. You write about it. I wrote about it. But I think that people underestimate its power. And one of the things that you were talking about were like the ring ceremonies, the purity ring ceremony. I also know that there are purity balls and it really puts people in a double bind. I have a friend whose daughter got to the age where their particular church was doing, you know, prepping kids for the ring ceremony. And for people who don't know what that is, it's like, it's a formal, this did not happen when I was growing up, but I feel quite sure that it's probably in the churches that I used to attend. It's a formalized process by which kids go through, I think it's 6 weeks of, you know, getting ready to go through the ceremony. And then the father usually puts a ring on the daughter's finger, and then that represents that she will remain pure until marriage, when she can, you know, give her husband the ring as proof of staying pure until marriage. But I remember my friend, that may be a really simple way of saying that. But anyway, my friend's daughter was traumatized by this. Speaking of trauma, she didn't want to do it, not because she didn't want to stay pure, but she was really forced. And so you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you go through with it and you don't really want to, then you sort of punish yourself. But if you don't go through it, then it signals to the community, you know, why doesn't she want to do this, right? So it's like it's a complete double bind for people. But will you speak a little bit more to that? I mean, I have lots of things that I want to ask about, but I want you to speak to it first.
Oh, absolutely. I think purity culture at a baseline has taken the worst parts of various points in history and mash them together into a modern nightmare, to be perfectly honest, because the purity balls come from the coming of age cotillion sort of being introduced into society baseline. And that was, you know, in previous eras, that was your coming of age, you're being introduced, you're finally getting to get a little taste of adulthood. But instead of being this revelation of, you know, moving into this new space where you are gaining more status and learning how to be a proper adult, you're pretty much being told you're someone's property and you're an object, and that your value, your entire value as a woman, as a person, is to not engage the world at all in order to be this perfect vessel who turns into a wanton, you know, harlot only for your husband once the ring is on your finger, once the marriage contract is signed, then you need to be available at absolutely all times. And it creates, one, it uses shame and control. When we, you know, Brené Brown has covered plenty on shame, but shame and trauma go hand in hand with one another. Trauma creates shame and shame creates trauma. And when it's used as a method of control, there is no magical way, whether you put a ring on someone's finger or sign a marriage contract or have someone bless your marriage, you don't magically get rid of that shame. And there are other writers and other, you know, folks who have talked about this. When this happens, you can't magically get rid of all of that shame. And so even the most perfect inside the circle couple who did everything right very often is now in marriage that they can't communicate with each other because they're ashamed. And when we reduce women to objects, I believe we are going exactly against the Bible, because Jesus tells men that they should cut off their hands and pluck out their own eyes if they can't control themselves. But yet purity culture says that it's a woman's bare shoulder is so distracting that she must be sent home in order to protect the men from themselves. And what does that say about men? That right. They, you know, that degrades men.
Yes.
Because are we making animals of the men we should be upholding and also seeing the image of God in? Because we talk so much about how we need to uplift the women, but that puts men in a double bind as well, that they are given a framework of nothing but entitlement, and that they are like, they are entitled to be responsible, but that they are inherently lustful and uncontrolled unless women do all the right things. And that puts men in a bind as well.
Yes, and I love that you say that purity culture is toxic for women and men for the reasons that you just said. The other thing that you kind of talked about is that these nearly impossible codes, these are codes that I was raised with that I remember, you know, like how to be a godly Christian woman. And I remember being in college and in an intro to GLB something or other. I don't know, but we were talking about markers of gender. And I remember looking around the room that particular day, and I was the only person that was practically all in pink dress, covered from here, you know, like from like everything covered up with the long hair, with the perfect makeup. I mean, like I was incredibly marked, you know, gender marked, but they are, it's impossible. You can't like codes of conduct, codes of dress, codes of thought. How do you prevent your thoughts? You can't like, you can't stop your thoughts from happening. It's, but, and so you feel like for me, I used to feel so guilty that I would have thoughts and shameful that I would have thoughts, but you can't stop your thoughts from coming. And in the same way I was thinking about when you were talking about the purity balls, like going back to the purity ring. So research shows that the majority of teenagers are going to fool around before that, you know, ring gets handed off. And what that makes me think of is all of the added shame. So you already have the shame, right? But then you break the covenant with God and with your family and with yourself, which only heaps shame upon shame. Very traumatizing.
Exceedingly. And it's interesting because when we look at this, I talked about it a little bit in my thesis, but it's around the concept of pet sins.
Yes, that was what I want to know about.
Yes, Chris, you got, okay, yes, we're all ears.
When we talk about, so this is a term I made up because it came up during TikTok, but I was talking about the fact that purity culture is like diet culture. And there's actually, I took a class on food and culture in my undergraduate, which I did a paper on the parallels between food culture and sex culture, which is an entire different topic about our restrictive behaviors and taboos parallel one another in those two. And so this is something that I've been thinking about for a bit. When you think about diet culture, we tell people that their bodies are inherently wrong. In purity culture, we tell people that their bodies are inherently wrong. In diet culture, we tell you don't eat the bad food. We categorize food as good or bad, and we tell you not to eat the bad food and to fixate on thinking about not eating the bad food. In purity culture, we tell you to fixate on not doing the bad things that your body is wired inherently to want. We're doing the exact same thing. Now, I would argue that obviously sexuality is not a need like food. That is the main difference, is that it's not we think about it as a drive, and the book Come As You Are is a great discussion of unpacking that particular topic. But there are many parallels culturally. And when we have pet sins, we literally are generating a hyperfixation of our minds, of our culture, upon the very things we don't want people to be doing or focusing on. It puts you into the catch of, don't think of a pink elephant. Well, if I hadn't said that, maybe you wouldn't have thought of it.
Right.
But if we are sitting here and I am telling teens whose hormones are bouncing all over the place, who are curious about having adult style relationships, who are thinking about falling in love, whose every moment is categorized by music and media and interactions that are heightening that awareness of trying to be someone and be someone with someone else. How exactly does telling them that these inherent desires are horrible and make them horrible people? And how are we doing anything but generating a compulsive hiding of sexuality and relationship, which then mutates it from something healthy and godlike and responsible to compulsive and hidden and addictive? Because then you have the behavior of shame, compulsion, shame, repentance, act, compulsion, fixation, and you go through this cycle again and again. And it's the same one we see in the trauma cycle that leads to all sorts of addictions, whether that's, you know, and then we have societal shame. And I'm sure you've seen this in talking about incarceration and the way that that's stigmatized. And there's an entire pattern there that most of our incarcerated populations are profoundly traumatized.
Traumatized, yeah.
And a lot of them are profoundly traumatized by purity culture just as much as other things, because they come from environments of extremism. And there's a whole tie in there that we don't ever think about.
Chris, it makes me think of two things. One, you know, Oklahoma is considered part of the Bible Belt, but we have one of the highest teenage pregnancy rates in the nation. But the other thing is that I used to be a graduate teaching assistant for a couple of professors in our religious studies department. And one of them sponsored our religious studies student association. And she was talking to the president one time, the president, it was a young man. And she asked this young man, what is it that people are struggling with? What is it that students are struggling with? She expected to hear alcohol, right? I mean, like, that's the big problem that people talk about on campus. But what he said was pornography. Mm-hmm. People are struggling with pornography. And I kind of relate that to what you're saying. It's like we push it down, push it down, push it down. Doesn't have a healthy way to come up. So it's coming up through addictions to pornography.
Absolutely.
And when kids get to school and they've got, you know, less supervision, this kid was saying it gets worse in college because you've got more freedom to kind of hide. So I think that's so fascinating that churches are creating the problems that they're trying to prevent in this way.
If we think about healthy church, healthy religious community, what are we teaching people to do? We are supposed to be helping people in their whole lives. That's the function of the church, right? If we believe in a higher power, if we believe in God, divinity, whatever you want to call it, that's supposed to be about our whole lives, right? That's our alignment. That's what we are living into.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So if I were to tell you as a teenager, money is bad, don't deal with money, never handle money, only once you hit 35 can you handle money, okay? And I told you that money was bad, and I never told you how the systems worked, and I said money is bad until you hit 35. Let's just, because it's an arbitrary thing, right? Now, I never told you how to handle that. At 35, I told you, here's a portfolio, here's some stock options, here's all the things you could do with money. Have fun, You'd be overwhelmed.
Yeah, good luck. Yeah, good you'd luck. Be overwhelmed.
You'd,
yeah.
You'd probably spend yourself out of money immediately, having no idea how to manage it. And if you'd been taught, if you'd been raised on nothing but glam TV about how awesome spending all this big money in mega mansions are, you would have a completely skewed idea about how to use money. Well, what are we doing with sexuality? Exactly the same thing. We're hiding it so much that we are putting people into a place where they have only pornography as their example of what healthy sexuality is. We're not teaching them because we're so ashamed of it. And this requires teaching the adults who were also raised in shame.
Yes.
Because they can't teach their kids unless they have been cared for. Their pain, their trauma has to be seen first, because we can't teach the next generation until we have people healthy enough to hold space for the generations coming up.
That's right. That's so well said. Well, I want to shift from these theologies of control to another big area that you talk about, because I think it's sort of a strange left turn, but it does relate. The use of like fear, the use of threats and fear to achieve obedience and compliance. And certainly that use of fear around matters related to sexuality is a big piece. Oh my goodness. I mean, I was raised in churches where to even think a sexually impure thought was like, you know, like you're on the road to hell. So, I mean, you know, it's just like, and how do you not have those thoughts? But will you speak to, I know that I read and I loved this, God is the ultimate panopticon, threats of hell. I would add gaslighting in kind of this bigger category, but will you just speak to the use of threats and fear and the impact? Because I know you like to, and I love this, that you've added in the psychological impacts. So would you just tell us, share your thoughts with us about that?
Sure. So one of the things that shows up is that it is so much easier to make people afraid than it is to make them trust. We have a primal brain part that goes, the minute we have fear, our higher functionings are like, nah, no. And so when we move into a place of fear, we can't think logically. We start thinking in a all or nothing way. And this is something that I'm actually looking at writing a book on, because I talk about the fact that we have the imago Dei, the image of God in all of us. But we have what I also call the imago Simi, the image of the poof-linging monkey in each of us. Because at the moment when we become afraid, our ability to connect to this higher self is muted in biochemically. And so while we have to honor the highest potential of every single person we meet, we also have to recognize the fear-driven, animalistic side of each one of us. And when we talk about authoritarian control or social programming or this idea of the all-knowing God, Santa Claus on doom, you know, mm-hmm, we have
right.
this kind of surveillance mentality in which we can't do anything because God is watching, because we're this tiny thing that is being this bug studied in a cage. And to me, that speaks the exact opposite of what the scriptures tell us that we are supposed to be experiencing. We're in, you know, scripturally, we're supposed to be experiencing an exaltation, a freedom, an understanding of the profoundness and alignment with divinity. And we are supposed to be free through faith, not afraid. Now, I think a lot of that, there's an entire, you know, dissertation that could be done on the mistranslations and misuse of the Hebrew language and the Jewish cosmology in Christianity. And I'm sure there are many dissertations on those things. But we have taken fear in Christianity, the fear of God, to mean abject fear rather than an awe, as an understanding of the greatness, of the profoundness, of the fact that we as a creation could never understand a creator kind of mentality. And yet we claim the authority to be the absolute knowledge of all that is in the world and declare that anyone we disagree with is going to hell, using this eternal punishment as an idea of of indoctrinating people to obedience to our idea of divinity rather than letting divinity guide us.
Yeah, it's like running from hell and Satan, frankly, versus running toward God and heaven. Like that was a big part of what I realized about my own journey, was that my whole upbringing, I wasn't running toward God. I was running from Satan. It was like, I didn't want to go to hell. So the panopticon, God is the panopticon. I'm trying to think of how, God is watching. I was talking with a young woman once who said that it's like, she said, being in my church and church home is like having 1,000 parents, because it's not only God watching, it's like your community watching. One time she wore spaghetti straps at a mall, and it got, by the time she got home, somebody had seen her and had, you know, the phone chain went into work and it had gotten back to her parents, and she got in trouble for wearing spaghetti straps in public. She knew she wasn't supposed to, right? But she thought she was safe. But it's like having 1,000 sets of eyes on you at all time.
I actually experienced things like that, you know, in myself when I was growing up, that kind of, you know, my mom was a teacher at many of my schools, to be fair. So having that kind of observation of things getting back to others. But I also liken it to my time in the military, where when you are in training status, one of the things they have you do is you have to wear your dress uniform at certain phases of training so that you're easily identifiable in public. Now, everyone else is in civilian clothes, so you don't know if anybody around you is somebody, some officer, somebody in your chain of command. You don't know if you're out in public. When you're in training, someone can correct you on your uniform, and you better do it because you have no idea who they are. And it's a form of social control. You have been flagged. And if you are part of these religious communities, you are flagged. And it is a constant, you know, paranoia. We're feeding paranoia. And there was a study recently talking about whether we could get people to have more open-minded viewpoints. And they finally were able to create more open-minded viewpoints in a study rather than only being able to create more closed-minded viewpoints, because they have study after study in psychology that show that inducing fear, priming for fear, can make people respond to political questions in a more conservative and fear-based way. But getting people to respond in a more open-minded or liberal way, and I don't mean American liberal or conservative, I mean just in the concepts in general, that they could get people finally by making them feel safe and seen. But it took a lot more priming to allow them to feel safe than it ever did to make them feel afraid. And we are indoctrinating entire generations with nothing but paranoia, fear, and catch-22s about their body, their identities, their sexualities, and their entire life in a constant image-based reality rather than what's truly inside of them.
I love the way you talk about gaslighting in this particular context, mostly because I am a pop culture nerd. So to hear it in this context is very interesting to me. I mean, to me, it was a movie from the 1930s, right? With Ingrid Bergman or whoever it was who was being gaslit. And that became a cultural phenomenon, so much so that the Chicks wrote a song about it. So I'm really interested to hear a little bit more from you about what you mean by gaslighting in this context.
So gaslighting is a term that's kind of gained popularity more recently, and it's kind of a buzzword at this point. And sometimes it's getting used right, and sometimes I think it's being used a little bit off. Gaslighting is a form of psychological crazy making as a larger umbrella term. Essentially, it is various actions, whether intentional or not, that make people doubt their ability to trust themselves. It's an undermining of self-agency at its most basic point. And gaslighting in context specifically is consistent lying in such a way, or consistent framing of things in such a way, that a person is unable to trust themselves. This happens a lot in religion. Women are taught not to trust themselves. They are taught that they are inherently wrong, that they are inherently bad, that they are going to end up chewed pieces of gum and wilted and rubbed and broken flowers, and that they're going to be a cup full of water that people have spit in. These are all metaphors that are used in purity culture to teach women about sexual purity. They are an object that is going to be sullied by their exposure to the world. And how much does that affect someone to be able to be told that their entire essence of being needs to be controlled by their pastor, by their priest, by their, you know, father, by their brothers, by who, any man who happens to be an authority near them rather than themselves? And it indoctrinates a sense of abuse because the men who are entitled and told their voice matters more than everyone else's their whole life now expect every single woman to just do what they say, be obedient, do those things. And the gaslighting, the internal trauma of not having self-agency is so profound. The lack of self-agency. And I still struggle with it because I grew up in those mentalities. And I still sit there, and there are times where I have very wonderful progressive male clergy who I have as colleagues, as I have as friends, and I still occasionally have to step back and go, I need you to stop for a second, because I see that I'm going into this automatic response where your voice is mattering more than mine here.
What is their reaction to that?
I've had a mixed response. They're mostly, I've felt comfortable doing that with people who I know, I've developed enough of a relationship with that I know I can say that to. I've been very lucky that there are some very wonderful progressive clergy in my area and online in the TikTok communities that I've become friends with who can hear that. Now, does it mean they're always, you know, perfect and they don't get defensive or they don't? No, they're human. You know, they have been indoctrinated into these things from the other side. But a lot of times it's learning how to have those relationships and have those conversations and say, hey, my agency just got taken. My power, you took my power right then. And I've overshot it myself, where I've had them come to me and go, you took my power in that moment. And it's a hard thing to hear. But I think it's something that we have to be able to have these conversations. We have to take this jumbled mess out of the closet. You know, I have that idea of, like, you know, that closet, or that it's like the junk drawer of closets. You know, you open it up and it's just teeming full of stuff and it's just falling out. That is what the mess we have currently with the state of religion and purity culture and indoctrination in our culture. And we've got to let that door open and all of the stuff fall out, because we can't sort that closet if we keep denying that the closet exists.
Right.
And that's where we're really at with that.
The analogy that I have in my mind of that, or the concept I have in my mind, is the big lumpy rug. You know, like we just sweep everything under the rug, and then you've got this rug with all kinds of lumps, and it's like, when are we going to pick the rug up and start cleaning up, you know, all the dirt and filth under the rug? Same thing, though. One example that I really want to share for people who want, like, a real, like, solid example of the gaslighting, and telling LGBTQIA plus people that if they just pray hard enough, because you wrote about this, but this is real germane to our neck of the woods. If they just pray hard enough, God will make them straight, right? And then when they're not straight, in quotations, then they just weren't praying hard enough, didn't do enough. And it's like they get blamed. So that's what you mean by, that's an example.
Absolutely. Because it's a catch 22. Because if you, and even if you have this around any other, your loss of faith, if you deconstruct and reject their ideology, you never truly believed. It's a common phrase.
That's right. That's the catch 22. You were never truly saved.
And so they are making narratives for you. It's when people make narratives for you and to so consistently that it undermines your truth. And it's profound and it's pervasive.
Can we jump back to your military stuff for just a minute? Because you wrote about military Christian exceptionalism. So I was reading one page and you were writing about that. And I wrote down Onward Christian Soldier. And then the very next page, you were referencing Onward Christian Soldier. And I'm like, yes. Also, I was thinking about, oh my goodness, prayer warriors for God. You know, it's like our youngest son played soccer with a church league when he was little. And they did it like a Bible study before every practice, which made him uncomfortable. But the thing that made him the most uncomfortable, because they pulled Bible verses, which were the scary ones, you know, it's like, and they would focus on those. But the thing that made him the most comfortable, trying to get him to pray, lead the prayer in the group. And they kept trying to say, you know, be a prayer warrior for Christ. And it just made him really uncomfortable. But also the decor at that church, it was not lost on me, was of a medieval castle with full standing, you know, like armor and, you know, like military style flags and stuff. But would you just speak to that a little bit? I know it's, you wrap that up into the larger context of paternalism. So you could speak to it however you want to. I think it's so germane.
I think it's an assumption already. It's so much into our assumption of what Christianity is. And I actually spoke to this recently on a TikTok talking about the fact that originally Christianity was a countercultural movement. It was to declare that Jesus was Lord was to declare that Caesar was not. To be in this moment of you know, most, if you understand the Gospels and you understand the writings and the letters of Paul, those are written in a context that everything he says that declares Jesus Christ as Lord is paralleling and is seditious against Caesar. And so when we look at this, Christianity was not militaristic. It was anti-militaristic. It was anti-empire, anti these authoritarian forms of control. But around the time that Christianity had the Council of Nicaea and was adopted into the Roman Empire, it took the mentality of entitlement, of conversion at the point of a sword, at this absolute narrative of what Rome had been for so many eras before it ever became Christian. But then it took the Christian mentality of persecution with it. And what it did then is parallel a mentality that says that I am being persecuted if you do not accept my entitlement. And we see this become a form of political control. It makes Christianity, and has been throughout the eras of Christianity in Europe and America. I won't speak because Christianity is actually not a monolith, and it has multiple varied elements in different elements outside of Europe and America. But speaking to that mentality of Christianized Europe, of the Roman Empire, of what it became then even in America, we have a Christianity that is vulnerable to political leverage because it can be used as a measure of control. The togetherness is created by the idea of shared persecution, and then they are indoctrinated to a militaristic entitlement of their ideas controlling the world.
Where the ends justify the means.
Absolutely, to them. And that's one of the ideas of the baseline of this. You know, and the funny thing is, the Onward Christian Soldier song was not initially meant to be militaristic. If you look up the history, it was a guy watching his kids go to school, I believe. I have to look up the exact details, but I remember looking this up at one point and going, well, that's not what it's used for. But it is an idea, however, that we have fetishized, especially in America, this, you know, fetishization of the knight, of the Crusades. And I'm sorry, fetishizing war is just a bad thing in general. Like, can we agree that putting this idea onto the face of God as a wonderful thing is probably a bad take?
Yep, we can agree on that. For sure.
We can.
But that's what we've done. And then we've come up with these narratives where we come up with extremism of, we're all in a spiritual battle in the end of days, and we're making a death cult of Christianity, because then it becomes all about your spirit and not about your mental, physical, or psychological wellness. It becomes all about the ends truly justify the mean, but the ends aren't even physical. They are a multi-level marketing, creating a spiritual downline of number of people you've converted, regardless right. of how you did that.
Right. Yeah. And there was something that you said about that, regardless of how they feel about that. Well, it just made me, I had a thought that left my head, but it also makes me think about how this comes up in weird ways. This, you know, we are able to kind of approach people however we want, because the end goal is to win their souls. And it makes me think of even in like subtle ways. So before the pandemic, actually, when I was writing my dissertation, this is when I hung out in coffee shops. Just the fact that I would have people approach me in a public coffee shop and proselytize and want to pray with me. And I remember, and it happened more than once in my town. And I remember going, oh, so this is the new thing. So when I was growing up, we would go door to door, I'm sure there's people. But nobody, when people would approach me, they would sit down. Nobody asked if I was, do you mind if I sit down? That would have even been the first consent, right? Going back to your sense of consent, I didn't give consent to just, you know, have my writing interrupted and then ask. You know, it's that whole series of questions that you get asked, and they would just go right through them. Can we pray with you and pray over me in this public space? Because I'm sure that they got to go away feeling really good because they
use social contract.
Yeah.
They use the social contract of reciprocity. This is why you get people who are part of religious groups that will hand you something, be it a pencil, be it beads, be it anything else. It's a marketing tactic. And invading someone's space and putting them slightly off kilter is yeah. actually a baseline psychological control mechanism. Because
okay.
it puts you off your pace. You see this actually.
It did, because you don't want to be rude.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
But it takes advantage of nice people because
yes.
you don't want to be rude. If you ever look at some of the terrible, the men's negging and like men's how to catch a date kind of narratives, if you go into any of those kinds of spaces where it's really toxic masculinity about how to catch a woman or date whoever you want, those workshops, I've studied the psychology of those extensively, and they use these exact kind of tactics. They put somebody off balance. They kick in their social niceness. They use gaslighting and degradation in order to make you feel uncomfortable. And then feel, and so that you say yes out of a teehee, I'm nervous, yes, not mm-hmm. a genuine one.
Right, right.
And this, weirdly, taught me a lot about Christianity. Studying that was like, oh, well, that's every conservative Christian who's ever stepped into my space. And now they may not be knowing that that's exactly what they're doing, but they're taught it by the culture. It's
exactly.
not explicit.
Yep.
It's an implicit and secondary factor of how it works. Because what happens? You've got a male pastor or priest or someone else who has no problem putting his hands on anyone in the congregation he wants to, who has no accountability because he is a man of God, who at most his accountability is, I messed up and I have to own that up. But then he gets kudos points for owning up to it.
Right.
You know, he
right.
gets
yeah.
he gets an extra checkbox and a sticker. But if you are a woman in that environment and you admit to something, you become, you know, the whore of Babylon. And they use that phrase against you.
Yeah, of
and,
course.
And, you know,
Jezebel. Yeah.
And I've been called many of those online. We get that a lot,
yeah.
actually.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I remember I was a cheerleader for our high school and we played a religious school one time. And, you know, back in those days, the cheerleaders would go around to the other side and that squad would introduce you would just get introduced to the other side's fans. And I just remember people yelling down Jezebel at us because they thought our skirts were too short. And granted, this was in the 80s when the skirts weren't that short. You know, I mean, it's not like the 50s where they were at the knee, but it's not like now. But yeah, Jezebel, and their players weren't allowed to look in our direction. It was just very, very strange.
Well, there's so much to talk about in your work, Chris. And unfortunately, we've run out of time today. But we would love to stay in touch with you. And we do and will follow you on social media. And we thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you both. This has been a wonderful time. And I'd love to, you know, chat some more because this is such a complex and wonderful topic that we really need to be talking about.
We'd love to have you back sometime.
We absolutely would.
We didn't even get through all of our stuff. I knew we wouldn't, but it's so good. It's so good, Chris.
So listeners, you can find the links to Chris's excellent thesis in the show notes, along with links to her social media accounts. Chris, again, thank you for being with us today. It was lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TCPodcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.